Turn with me, if you will, please, to Matthew chapter 8. The NAV work in the U.S. is structured so that we have area representatives, and then we have contact points of one kind or another, and none of them are too clear to us as to which is what kind and which is the other kind. We don't worry about this because we intend for this to be a little fuzzy, both in the minds of the general public and the minds of the people who are doing the contacting, pointing, and the people that are here at the Glen. We don't mind this fuzziness, this haziness. It keeps us from becoming official, semi-official, non-official, sub-official, official at all, you see, in these things. It's just whatever the Lord does in these spots. We know who's out there, and we have our ways of keeping in contact with them, either through correspondence or through the area representatives. The area representative, he has been given an area, a town, like say the town of Lincoln, Nebraska, or the town of Minneapolis, or the town of Washington, D.C. And then as the Lord expands his ministry and he begins to extend out and go from here to there and the other place, why, certain people become his contacts or the contact point for this particular spot. So right now over at Brookings, South Dakota, Bill Cole is a contact in a contact point, and he kind of looks to Jerry Marshall for his guidance and leadership. Daryl Anderson back here is at the University of South Dakota at Vermilion, and he sort of looks to Russ Johnson as sort of his person he keeps in touch with by way of the area representative. But if you would ask either one of them, are they navigators, they would say no. Well, are they official? And then no. They're just out there doing the job that God has laid on their heart. This is not to say they won't be navigators someday, but right now they're just out there doing the work. Take a fellow like Granville Norris over here up in Ankeny, Nebraska, or Ankeny, Iowa, excuse me. He's a businessman. And he does the work up there. He does the work of the navigators. But he's a layman, works in his church, has no official connection with us whatsoever, but he just kind of has on his heart what we have on ours. 250 miles, this area representative has kind of been given as their sort of maximum range. And so therefore we have what we call supervised and unsupervised contacts. Person down at Memphis, like Dave Bradford, he is a contact point down there, doing the work, doing it well, but sort of unsupervised. And we're moving out of that idea more and more and trying to locate people in this supervised contact, because we find we get much more done when a guy is a member of a team. Far more done. So the fellows that work with Jack Mayhall back in his region, once in a while they get together. And they all band together for some sort of big key man's meeting. And they find themselves gathering at Kalamazoo. And they meet there. And they spend the weekend together, praying and planning and thinking and about their next conference and about this, that, and the other thing. And it's helpful for them to work on a team, to be part of a gang. Well, now, there is a passage of Scripture that I looked at some time back and shared with the Glen gang here. I guess it was the middle of last winter. I can't remember when it was. And then again with the gals over at the Pink House during staff conference that I would like to share with you, that I think sort of gives our philosophy of our contact point operation. But it's in Matthew 10, but I've got to start in Matthew 8. It says, when he was come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. And there came a leper. Verse 2. Verse 5 said, there came unto him a centurion, saying, Lord, my servant lieth sick at home. Verse 14, he went to Peter's house, and his wife's mother laid sick of a fever. Verse 16, when even was come, they brought in him many that were possessed with devils. Verse 28, two possessed with devils, exceeding fierce, so that no man might pass that way. Chapter 9, verse 2, they brought him to a man sick of the palsy. Verse 18, there came a certain ruler, worshipped him, saying, my daughter is even now dead. Verse 20, a woman which was diseased with an issue of blood, 12 years, came and touched the hem of his garment. Verse 27, two blind men followed him, crying, saying. Verse 32, they brought him a dumb man possessed with a devil. And so verse 30, 36 says, and when he saw this multitude, He was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were a sheep having no shepherd. And he said unto his disciples, the harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Now, I understand that Matthew sort of bunches some of these things up and sort of gets everything taken care of once, you know, like all the healing and all this, that, and the other thing. And I don't know about all those things because I have never had this really clearly explained to me. But it's obvious to me, just in reading through on this, that Jesus was busy. And there was lots of work to do. And lots of people in need of help. And from every quarter they came to him with one kind of need or another. And so after surveying this for a day or for 2 days or for 10 days or for 10 weeks, he finally called his disciples together and said, look, the harvest is plenteous. There's a big job here. Lots of people need help. But the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore, the Lord of the harvest, that he will send forth laborers into his harvest. Pray ye therefore. One of the things that caused the heart of Jesus Christ to be moved with compassion was when he saw people wandering around with no leadership, with no one to shepherd them, with no one to help them. I cross-reference this with Numbers 27, 15 and 16, where Moses is praying. Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, that he may go out before them and come in before them, that he may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord be not as sheep which have no shepherd. Or 1 Peter 5, 2 and 3, where the Lord or where Peter here is explaining some things to the elders. And he says, feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof. Not by constraint, but willingly. Not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but in samples to the flock. People don't need a lord. They've got one. That's all anybody needs. One lord. But they could stand to have some people around them that know what to do and how to do it, to sort of be examples that they can watch. Someone to set the pace. Someone to set the example. Not another lord, however, Peter says. You got one. That's plenty of lords. So then you cross-reference this with Matthew chapter 20. Verse 25. But Jesus called them unto him and said, ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them, but it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. So what's the job of the leadership? The job of the leadership is to serve everybody else. To serve. And so he says in 2 Corinthians 1:24, not that we have dominion over your faith, but are helpers of your joy. For by faith you stand. And I could go on here with some other verses. Jot down for your own. You can look them up later. Matthew 23:6-12. I guess that's enough. I've got others, but I don't want to confuse you with a multitude of verses here. Well, then how does this apply? Well, this applies very simply. When people work with me on the conference crew here, let's say, in the summertime, nobody works for me. People work with me. I don't have a crew where I'm the crew leader and have a, you know, let's go, you people. We have a gang. We have a mob. We have a group, a team. This is the idea. We're all in this thing together. And nobody works for anybody else. Dawson Trotman did more things right by accident than most of us do after prayer and fasting. And do you know what Doss had? Doss had a dear gang. There's tremendous power in those words if you think about it. He didn't have his this or his that. He had what he referred to as a dear gang. I think this is what the Lord is trying to get at here in all of these verses that we've shared about the Lord's philosophy of leadership. So he says, the heavy harvest, few workers. And this problem we'll always have. So when you get back to your area or to your contact and your contact point or wherever you happen to be at the moment, and you discover there's lots of work to be done and few laborers, why don't say, well, they, you know, it's all brand new. It happened back here. It happens. It's always true. But, he says, because of that, pray. Pray, therefore, the Lord of the harvest. And I think that when I was in an area, I spent more time on this point, praying for laborers, than any other kind of prayer. I spent more time in it than in intercession, in petition, thanksgiving, confession, praise. I spent the bulk of my prayer time asking God for laborers. Laborers to harvest the crop. We used to have our conferences back in the Midwest in the chicken coops of Sioux City. And we had some wild times back there. People would have to take off their shoes and walk back and forth, you know, because of the mud. And then the girls, I'd sit there and I'd preach, and they'd sit there and they'd wiggle their toes and squish this mud around between their toes, you know, as I would preach to them. Vidano says, the troops grew up in the coops, is the way he thought about it. We were on our way to these chicken coops one time for a conference, and I stopped at a restaurant to get a bite to eat and started to witness to this lady that owned the restaurant and was going to talk to her about the Lord. And she says, you're the second one that's talking about that today. I said, I am? Yeah. Who was the other person? Well, I don't know. He was going up. So I found out he was going to a Navigator conference. So I got to the Navigator conference and I said, find out who witnessed to that lady in that restaurant. Some of the key guys, they, you know, scrounged around and finally discovered Jim North was the guy that witnessed to her. So I put his name down and I prayed for him for every day for 2 years that God would give us that guy. You see, it is a rare bird these days who on his own initiative, when he has an opportunity sitting in a restaurant and someone is there just chatting about this, that, and to turn the conversation to spiritual things and talk to them about Jesus Christ. That is a rare occurrence. And when I find someone like that, I put them down and I begin to pray for them. God, that's the kind of people we want in our bunch. This is what I think the Lord is talking about. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest, that he will send forth laborers into the harvest. After 2 years, the magic moment came and I talked to Jim. He said, no, I can't, Leroy. I can't come up to Lincoln and live with you. He said, I've got to go home and work in the fruit market. I said, what did you do last summer? Work in the fruit market. What did you do summer before? Work in the fruit market. How about summer before? Work in the fruit market. But how long do you intend to give your life to a dumb fruit market? He came up and was with us. And some of you know him. He was trained to be a boxer, and his dad taught him to be mean. And Russ Johnson was living with us at the time, and Russ was in charge of the crew, and Russ did not feel that Jim washed dishes fast enough in the early days. And I thought we were going to have knockdowns and dragouts there for a while, but it worked out all right. Well, this is what the Lord did. He saw this fantastic need for laborers, and so he got a few around him. He got 12, in fact, it says in chapter 10, verse 1. And when he had called on him his 12 disciples, he gave them power and so on. So he got 12 men. He got some men. He had 12 who were close. He had 3 who were closer, you remember. He had 70 who were co-laboring with him. The 70, the Bible calls them. And there was the multitude. But he had a core of men who were very hard at the center. This is the key. to an effective operation, to have a core of men who are very hard at the center, who live for one thing and one thing only, who have nothing else. Philippians 2:25, I think, expresses this about as well as anything I've come across. He talks about the three kinds of people that he's worked with. Paul does. And they're all important, obviously. And they have, each of them has their own function. But he says, this man, a brother, a companion in labor, and fellow soldier. Well now, I have lots of brothers in Christ. And brothers have one thing in common. We all have a common father. Then you have this companion in labor fellow. Your companion in labor is someone who is involved in sort of the common work. We're all kind of laboring together in a common work. And I think of Marv Ladner. I think of Gene War. I think of Dr. Ed Anderson. I think of Bob Bremner back here. I think of guys that are involved just as kind of our co-laborers in the work. We've got a common work to do, a common vision. And then out of that bunch, God puts his hand on a few who become our fellow soldiers. They sort of give everything else up. They give up their job, they give up this, they give up that, and they kind of come with us and work with us on a fellow soldier basis. This is what I think Jesus had in the 12. This is what we have on the NAV staff. Interesting, those of you that have books and you can look into this thing, Bob back here, Bob Malcolm. You might want to look up that word fellow soldier, Bob, in the original Greek and just see what it's all about. It's one of the most interesting words that you'll ever come across. It has to do with those that have shared our dangers, those that have shared with us in our hardships, those that have suffered with us. This is kind of the idea here. That inner hard core. Therefore, one of our basic philosophies in the NAV work, as most of you know, has come out of this concept, the band of men idea. The band of men. And so we work in and through this band of men and develop a team. And we've been getting this out now in the log from time to time, the team efforts in the overseas work, or Lauren's little talk on the band of men and steering straight one time and so on. The band of men or the team. Verse 5 says, in the New English it says, then Jesus sent these men out with the following instructions. So, here then come the instructions as to what to do when you go out. Go not into the way of the Gentiles and into the city of the Samaritans, enter ye not. Jesus had in mind a certain pool of manpower that he wanted his men to work in. He had some that were kind of off limits. And of course, we all, you know, there's all kinds of reasons for all this. But the facts are that he had a certain pool of manpower that he wanted them to work in. Therefore, we have in mind a certain pool of manpower. Let's say someone comes to the Glen and works with us here for a year or two and then goes out. We have in mind that fellow's working in a certain specific pool of manpower. And we have sort of put these things in our minds. This is kind of true all through. Remember Galatians chapter 2, verse 7? He's been called to this group, I've been called to that group. All right. Our servicemen, as you know, is our number one priority in the Navigator work. Working among the fellows in the service. This is by and large our greatest concentration of manpower. And we find that shipboard personnel provide our best pool of manpower among servicemen. Very little distraction. Nothing for them to do especially. The guy has an opportunity to live the life in front of these people 24 hours of a day. Then isolated bases is another one. And we find that a person who is working in an isolated base where these men are always running off on liberty someplace is better than another kind. Or a service school. We find this is a good pool of manpower, where men are around long enough for us to not only win them to Christ, but also follow them up. Fourth priority on our list is an ordinary base. And we have a real problem here. And I'll tell you what it is. The general problem of an ordinary base is that guys are just not there. Weekends and so on, they kind of scatter. As far as the isolated base, this is not true. But here's our problem. We've got a heavy concentration of men working with overseas service personnel and doing a bang-up job. Now, we've got our categories over there doped out the same way. And so you'll find us in Germany. You'll find us working with the isolated spots. Little Bittyberg up here, you know. Boy, you have a hard time getting out of Bittyberg because that's isolated. And somebody... Okay, now... A guy gets underway, and so he comes back and lands in the States. Well, now the Army has no particular interest in our philosophy of where we want to work with men, and so then they take and stick these guys in places where we have no intention of going. Now, that if anyone can come up with a solution to that one, I'd like to know what it is. That, to me, is a real problem. Boy, these guys pour 2 years of their life into them over there. They come back. They're just now 2 years old, maybe a year and a half, just getting underway. They need the continued follow-up. That's a burden on my heart, and I don't know what to do about that. Our fifth thing is a recruit training center. A recruit, you know, where they just have one liberty, and off they go someplace. They've got their boot camp over with, and off they go. Well, I think I would rather see a good big service center in operation there than I would some kind of NAV philosophy that we have in operation at home and so on. Now, among the college crowd, this is also a concentration of ours. We like a big dorm, a big school in a small town. Same reason. Isolated. Therefore, I would rather work at Stillwater, Oklahoma, than I would at Columbia in New York City. Less distractions. Less things for them to do. Less, you know, Mickey Mouse for them to get involved in. I would rather work in a dormitory school than I would a streetcar school. Because they're bunched up. They're accessible. You go into a streetcar school, you go in and kind of, there they are in class, but when the class is over, you know, it's kind of like Merlin the Magician, poof, and they're gone. Now what? I don't know how to work with that bunch yet. I would rather work in a study school than I would a party school. Therefore, we think that we would rather concentrate a man at Kansas State University, like we have with Carl McCutcheon back here, than at the University of Kansas. Because it's less of a party school. We would rather work at Iowa State than at the University of Iowa. We would rather work at Penn State than either at Pitt or at the University of Pennsylvania. A different kind of fellow. A different environment. We would rather work among agriculture or engineering students than we would just a rather ordinary, whatever you call these other things. Say a philosophical... I would rather work with a man... at Stillwater again, Oklahoma State University, than I would the University of Chicago. You find fellows who are interested in religion at the University of Chicago, and they're sitting around trying to struggle through the fine shades of difference between Bart, Bruner, Boltman, Tillich, Niebuhr, and so on. Whereas at Oklahoma State, you get some guys who are interested in religion, and they're thinking in terms of production. This is the kind of man they are, about doing something. And so they think in terms of getting some verses memorized, getting their Bible study done, getting some witnessing done that week, and so on. It's a whole different kind of man. And I don't know what to do about this other one. I would rather work with a man interested in production than I would just, you know, trying to dope out fine shades of difference between this, that, and the other thing. So we work out our pools of manpower on the basis of these guidelines that I've given you in our contact point philosophy in the States. Dr. Garrett, whom I've never heard of until I read this thing, he's a PhD, apparently he's over in Tokyo, Japan, doing something over there. But he wrote this, and it really stuck with me. It is enlightening to observe that we find here, on the whole, men of action rather than contemplation. Men uninhibited by training in intellectual, social, or religious traditions. He wrote a book called How Jesus Trained Leaders. Not a book, it's a pamphlet. About this size, 1.5 by 11. Oh, it's a little thicker, about twice this thick. How Jesus Trained Leaders. And he points out that these people, they all come out of one general kind of man that he chose. Well, he says in verse 6, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as you go, preach, saying, proclaim, saying. So he told them what their message was to be. He gave them specific instructions to what to preach. Now, people have a problem with the navigators, some people, in that they think they were too specific along this line. But after you work at something for 35 or 40 years, you discover that the wheel is basic. And when people get away from that wheel, you're getting away from the thing that's basic. And so we continually say, okay, the wheel, the hand, how to get into the Word, the bridge illustration. We try to help people be specific and learn how to communicate basic truths in a simple way. And we find this is important. People have problems with our Bible studies. They say they're too simple. They're crude. They're childish. These little question and answer things, for instance. And that's true. I agree with all those things. And I think if anything else about them, I'd agree with that too. We don't want a complicated Bible study. We don't want a sophisticated Bible study. The objective of a Bible study is that, look at it like a pickaxe. It helps you get down underneath to where the gold is. And there's nothing very sophisticated about a pickaxe. It's a tool that helps you get down into the thing that you're trying to reach. Verses 8 to 10. He explains to them what their financial policy should be. You know, brass in your purse, gold, script, and so on. Their financial policy. Therefore, when people leave the glen, we try to explain to them what their financial policy should be. Take Elvin Smith. He left here and went to Seattle. We said, Elvin, when you get up there, get a job. Go to work. And you work and support yourself until the ministry demands that you give it full time. And when that happens, you'll know it because there'll be some people coming around and say, look, you're involved too much over here in this work. Why don't you give up that job and we'll kind of pick up the slack and make sure that you eat and have a place to sleep and so on, okay? Then you say, okay, and you can give yourself full time to the ministry. This is what Bob Stevens did when he went to Boston. We open up a new area. This is our general way of operation. Therefore, when fellows go here and go out to a contact point, normally they get a job and work until the ministry supports them. If that's the way the Lord leads. Okay. This, then, is the basic philosophy of the nav work worldwide. The navigators are supported 99.9% by people to whom we minister. Simple, isn't it? We apply that to the individual when he goes out. We apply it to the whole operation worldwide. We're supported by people to whom we minister. Not very complicated, is it? But we find that it's the way the Lord has led us to do. Verse 11, he says, inquire who is worthy. I think the New English says, look for some worthy person in the village or something along that line. I think that what the Lord is getting at here is that he wanted them to get the work started with the right people. I remember when Bob and Myrna came to me back in, I think at Urbana Missionary Convention, if I'm not mistaken, about 3 years ago, and talked to me about a certain guy moving in with them. I said, all right, now let me explain that to you. Or just at least discuss it with you so you have another point of view here. If he moves in, then that whole campus is going to say, ah, that's the kind of guy that the navigators are interested in. That is the man that he sort of illustrates to us and the kind of people that they really want to work with. And I said, I'm not sure that he is really the prime example of the kind of men that we are trying to recruit from this place. And both Myrna and Bob saw that. Said, yeah, I think you're right. In fact, I know you're right. The reason they were going to invite him into the home because he was so fouled up. He had big problems. Well, now, when you invite someone to come into your home, this is not a nursery. This is a boot camp. Now, there are great similarities between a nursery in the hospital and a Marine Corps boot camp, let's say. But there are also wide differences. They're both places of beginning, aren't they? But there are also other little factors in that make them, really different. And I think that the fellow that belongs in the nursery, we do violence to him when we invite him to come in too close. I can't explain why all those things are, but I've just seen this happen. So the Lord, points out various things. Paul said, now don't be in a hurry to ordain a man, or you may be making yourself responsible for his sins. I think the King James says, neither be thou partaker of another man's sins. Well, I don't either want to be responsible for or partaker of the thing that develops in the guy's life. So I'd rather hold him off for a while. Another thing about this, looking for someone worthy, don't be too excited about giving yourself to the first person that responds enthusiastically. Because there are still people around who respond enthusiastically to any new thing that comes along. Great, And man, you think, man, I've really got my... Whoa. And then all of a sudden some other new thing comes along. He's over there hollering, great, So just, that's a lesson. The kind of people that we're interested in. The kind of man that the people see that you have around is the kind of person that sets the standard. And by the way, I'm not talking about the big, the broad-shouldered guy or the gal with all the class and everything. I'm talking about the heart here. Because 1 Corinthians 1:27 is still in the book. God hath not chosen, but God hath chosen. And you know what they are. Come into the room and you want a drink. You're thirsty. And so you see all this fine glassware sitting around. It's from England, China, India, Israel, all this beautiful glassware. But all of it is just a little bit smudged. Maybe a little lipstick mark or a thumb smudge or some dust or something. And then right in the middle somewhere, or off to the side, I don't know, but sits this big old clean peanut butter jar. Has a label still on it. You know it's an old peanut butter jar. Obvious, but it's clean and sparkling. Now, which one are you going to use when you're thirsty and you want a drink? Therefore, don't look for all the outer trappings. See, there's something else involved here when we talk about the men to give your life to, not the outer trappings. Lauren talked to us about good seed last year. I think it was last year. He pointed out that good seed has life. Good seed has Christ's life. John 15:5, I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit, for without me ye can do nothing. Good seed has life. The second thing about good seed is that good seed must be sown in the field by Christ. When he putteth forth his sheep, he goeth before them. Christ putteth forth the sheep. Good seed must be sown in the field by Christ. Warren George apparently is on some kind of a kick about how to start a new work in an area. He's brought this up to me two or three times on various occasions. And I don't know what they studied back there, but it really got to him. And apparently I'm anxious to find out what it's all about. But I do know this. You do not start a work in a new area, when you plant the seed in the field, by just forays. You don't really get a solid work going at Penn State just zipping up there and spending a weekend and coming back, and then going back and helping a little and coming back, and going up and helping and coming back. Or at VPI on the East Coast, going down and getting things going and coming back, and go down and spend a couple hours and come back, You have to do one of two things. You have to take somebody out of there and bring them up and send them down where we can work with them for a while, or we've got to send somebody down there for a year or two. In the case of VPI, we sent Johnny Sackett down. Johnny went down, I think he took some classes even, lived down there, and spent time there. He and a guy named Teed Radin. And they were there. Good seed was planted. Now, good seed help us in finding out where the openings are. You make a foray down here. And four or five guys say, man, this is great. When are you going to come back? Well, a couple weeks. So you go back down. And there's all kinds of interest, there's all kinds of enthusiasm, and it lingers. So pretty soon the guy writes me and says, "Good night, Lee. We got to get somebody down there. We can't let those people down there, you know, suffer and agony and all. They want help." So I'm tenderhearted and I say, "Good night, Lauren. We can't let those guys suffer in agony down there. They really want help." So we pray and the personnel board meets, and pretty soon we think in terms of how to get somebody down there. But good seed must come from the nucleus. In an area of work, you've got your men who are hard at the center, and you've got their contacts, and you've got their contacts. When you plant a man for a couple years out here, you can't plant him from the fridge. You've got to plant him from the nucleus, because the good seed comes from the nucleus. You're hardcore. And that means that you've got it working like this. You've got your men coming in closer, and they stay around for a while, and they go out from there. That's where you get your good seed. Good seed has life, Christ's life. Good seed must be planted in the field. And good seed can reproduce. That's the third characteristic Lauren pointed out about. And he said, good seed must die. Now, you know the old booklet, Born to Reproduce? Die to reproduce. It's true we're born to reproduce, but it's true also that we must die to reproduce. Now, what does that mean? Well, one aspect of this, as I mentioned to one other group before, the reason I say one aspect of this is that I'm a moral coward, and I won't really come out and say this is what I really believe the whole thing is all about. But one aspect of this, at least, and I'll qualify it, is just not living for myself, but living for other people and for their needs and to help them. No longer living for myself, but living for the other guy, pouring out my life for that guy. 1 John 3:16, "Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." Isaiah 43:4, "So will I give men for thee, and people for thy life." Do you know that it's possible to trade that one life of yours for men? And if I read the scriptures carefully and correctly, thousands of men and thousands of gals. You can trade that one life of yours for thousands. But you must be willing to give up your life. And when you're willing to do that, you're in a position to see thousands multiplied as a result of your one life. But the reason why most people never see these thousands is because they hang on to that life. And they just will not share it with other people. So these three things about good seed. Therefore, the Lord said, choose your company wisely. Make sure you're involved with the right people. Verse 14. "Whosoever will not receive you, neither hear your words, and you depart out of the house, shake the dust off your feet." Interesting. I don't know why they wanted the dust shaken off the feet, but he said, spend time with a man that's willing, ready to learn. Not the passive individual or the closed individual, but the man who is eager, ready to go. Find some guy that's passive, why, you can pray that God will give him an eager spirit. Find some guy that's closed, why, pray that God will open him. But you look for the man with a burning heart. Three things to look for. Don asked me this last night on my way home, and I said, "Don, I don't have time to talk to you about it now, and anyhow, I think you should talk to Bill Cole or Bruce Stoss or some of these guys." But I'll share three things. I got these from Waldron Scott a while back. Does he have a heart for God? Two, is he willing to pay the price? Three, is he teachable? See, you find people that have a heart for God, but are not really teachable. But you find other people that are teachable, but they're not really willing to pay the price. So all three of these things go into this. Willing to pay the price. Work on problems in his life. And by the way, you can tell where a man is by the kind of problems that he has. You can tell whether or not a man is in the battle by the kind of problems he has. When we were on a little island called Peleliu, I just finished reading an account of this in a book called Marine, The Life Story of Chesty Puller. There it's called The Bloodiest Battle in the Pacific. There's another little paperback out called Coral Comes High, where it's also referred to as the Bloodiest Battle in the Pacific. Well, all I know, it was a mess when I was there. And here were our problems. We were running out of ammunition. We didn't have any water. My buddy over here had his arm blown off. We were trying to get a corpsman out to him. Another guy had his upper lip shot off. And we were trying to figure out what to do with this guy. And so on. These were our problems. While I was overseas, I was also on a little island called Pavuvu. Now, Pavuvu was our rest camp area. And I had the privilege, by the way, of reading off the commanding general who chose Pavuvu as a rest camp. I did it after I became a civilian. I met him at an ICL prayer breakfast in Washington, D.C., and he says, "Were you on Pavuvu?" And he began to apologize, and so I thought, well, I've got him on the go here, so I took advantage of the thing and gave him my impression of the place. Land crabs, flies, blowflies, mosquitoes, red ants, you name it. But our problems there were our tent leaked. I would wake up with land crabs in my shoes. We didn't have the proper food. It rained every day. Whereas my problems over here were my buddy had his arm blown off. We didn't have enough ammunition to carry on the battle. And you can just about tell where a person is, whether or not he is in the battle, by the kind of problems he comes and shares with you. If he comes and is always bringing up some little picayune-ish rear echelon problem that has nothing to do with the battle, then you know the guy is not in the battle. So you can just kind of keep your eyes open and figure out where the men are. Well, verse 16, I see that I'm not going to get through my last two pages, so verse 16, briefly. He tells them they'll face opposition. They will face opposition. Now, I learned a lesson when I was in Pittsburgh from Dawson Trotman. I faced opposition. There was a certain group back there that believed that our TMS was not Calvinistic enough. Our verses were not Calvinistic verses somehow. I'm not just sure how they, you know, I didn't even know the difference between Calvinistic and whatever else there was on the scene at the time. But I was really worried about it, so I wrote to Doss, and I said, "Doss, good grief, our verses aren't Calvinistic enough." And the guys were being told not to memorize them, and dear me, you know, and I was in a big, having a federal case over it. And Doss wrote back a very brief note. And he said, "You never get anywhere by spending your time solving problems. You get someplace by taking advantage of the opportunities that are before you. Therefore, claim a verse and get on with the job and forget the opposition." So I claimed the verse, "No weapon that will form against thee shall prosper." And I got on with the job, forgot the opposition. The opposition somewhere mellowed in the background. I never heard from it again. And we got quite a few guys into the TMS and got them rolling in their own lives. But you're going to face opposition. My advice to you, therefore, on the basis of my own experience, forget the opposition. Get on with the job. Ignore it. Claim some verses and do what you know God has called you to do. Well, verses 17 through 31. He tells them what their attitude should be toward opposition. And you'll find showing up, "Don't worry, don't be afraid, don't fear, have no fear." This whole thing, you know, is full of those things. And verses 32 and 33, he promises them an eternal reward. He tells them what the message will do. It will divide some. And there'll be a cost involved, 37 through 39. Verses 40 and 41, he impresses them with the importance of little things. Watch out for the little things. And by the way, interesting around the Glen these days, I observe that a guy will walk right over a cigarette butt and leave it there. Now, I know a day when that would not have happened. I wonder if we're getting a little slack on little things. Or a candy wrapper laying around somewhere. Walk over it and leave it there. Well, I know a day when this kind of thing would have been, really preached about. Hardly ever mentioned anymore. The importance of little things. I wonder, are we getting slack in some of the little things in your life or my life or in your area where you're working? Are we still trying to be sharp? You know, Then chapter 11, verse 1, it says, when he'd made an end of teaching all the disciples these things, he himself went out to preach and teach. There's a whole sermon there, by the way. He didn't say, well, good, my sermon is finished, and go sit down and in his private closet over here and relax while everybody else went out and do the work. He himself went out and got into the battle with them. Tomorrow we'll continue this contact point study, working more or less on methods.